This is side three of the interview with Bentley Glass at his home on Crane Neck on August
17, 1987. The things that I didn't feel I'd gotten to...
All right, then I have a list of a few things, too.
Some items about recruitment... the establishment of the Center for Continuing Education and the problems of getting a suitable dean and turnovers there and difficulties and so on. And then recurring problems relating to the chairmanships of departments.
Right.
About six or seven of those. And then appointment and tenure problems in other departments than political science. We talked about Michael Zweig and that problem, but
right.
I didn't mention some of the other cases where things were worked out, and I'd like to do that. Music, marine sciences, and CED.
Right.
Yeah.
You can go ahead and follow your agenda.
It shouldn't take nearly as long as the first interview, I think, to cover those items, but you may have a desire to go back and remind me that there's some of these questions that I haven't exactly touched on.
All right. You go ahead. You go ahead with what you want to do.
Oh, have you started it already?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
Yes. It follows right along, really, with what you were winding up on.
Yes. Well, a very large part of my time during the years I was academic vice president was spent in recruitment. I determined very early that as a matter of policy, I would try to interview personally everyone who was proposed for appointment at an associate professor's level or above, with special care to interview those who might be coming to take a chairmanship or an administrative post. And we got some awfully good people that way, also some, I won't name names that I think didn't work out so well, but the batting average was probably about 650, so I think that was reasonably good. We had many advantages in our favor in those years because our salary scale was in general at the top of state and private universities. It was only after I had retired in the 70s that the financial crunch led to a weakening of that relative position, and it's only now, actually, that it's beginning to recover. I think one of the very good appointments that I helped to engineer was the appointment of John Truxell as Dean of Engineering, when we knew that Tom Irvine wanted to retire as Dean. I think it was John Toll who had heard that Truxell might be available, that there were some problems at Brooklyn Poly that seemed disturbing to Truxell, and that he might be available. So having known him slightly before through the National Academy of Sciences, I worked on him.
Mm-hmm.
And that went through very nicely. I think all of those who were
given distinguished professorships,
except for Frank Yang, whose appointment was prior to my entrance on the scene and was engineered by John Toll. Yes. All of the others, worked out.
Kozer, for instance.
To work out. What?
Kozer?
Yes, Kozer. And, of course, Kazin was here already.
Yes. I had a hand in that.
Several others. Not too many. So in general, I could say that while we acquired a faculty that, in my opinion, was very good, it never quite reached the standard of excellence that we had hoped. Obviously, even when you get a lot of good people, there's still many unknowns in the situation. There was trouble at Dartmouth College. Biochemistry group there was very upset in their dealings with the dean and the president, and they were right on the point of resigning en masse. And I heard about that and made a trip up there to see them. And of the three senior members of that department, which was small but excellent, we got two, Melvin Simpson and Marty Freundlich.
Who was the third?
The third was
I think he had come from...
He went to Oregon, and I can't seem to remember.
I think he came from Albany.
It wasn't St. Georgie, was it? It was some relatively European name like that. I can't remember now.
Never mind.
I can look back and check it out if you want that.
Strongren's daughter was married to the chairman of the biology department at Albany.
Uh-huh.
And my recollection is that it was he that went to Dartmouth.
Strongren.
No, that was
not the name.
It wouldn't be, because he married Strongren's daughter.
Oh, yes, of course. I see. But this man.
But I forgot. Was it Allen?
Hmm?
Allen?
No.
All right. I'll have mine.
It may come to me later. Well,
we got two of them from Dartmouth.
Yes.
That's good. That's a good batting average.
Two out of three, yes. That was pretty good. And Melvin Simpson, of course, wanted to have some administrative responsibility, and I worked it out with the biology department. We had just the one department at that time. That he would constitute the leader of a subgroup, which would have virtual administrative autonomy within the biology department, biochemistry group. In a few years, we had some problems with Pellegrino, who wanted everything traditionally in medical schools to go over to his side of the campus. And both John and I were very strongly in favor of keeping most of the academic, non-clinical sciences in the College of Arts and Sciences. And eventually we compromised. We kept biochemistry and we gave up microbiology. And it hasn't really mattered a lot, because microbiology has always been housed in the same graduate biology building with biochemistry and the other biology departments. And the contacts have been very close. But Pellegrino wanted to have a separate College of Basic Sciences in the Medical Center, the Health Sciences Center. He couldn't do that, of course, without some of the typical non-clinical science departments as a basis. So we compromised. Like most compromises, it worked better in some respects than in others.
Right at that point, when Malcolm Muir and Lester Evans came into my office, mm-hmm. about 2 months after I'd been on the job, one of the reasons they were interested in Stony Brook was that our administrative structure was not set in concrete at the time, and they wanted to put a new health science center on the campus of a relatively new institution, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. so that the administrative relationships could be worked out in harmony without the older institution dominating the medical school. How do you think that has worked out at Stony Brook?
Well, Pellegrino was not a person to stand for any domination. And although technically he was, he reported to me as academic vice president, he was essentially autonomous, and we recognized it that way. It has been, I think, rather too autonomous, not sufficiently integrated with the scientific departments and the other departments. Pellegrino's idea was to build a kind of independent health sciences center that would be self-sufficient. And his broad cultural interests in philosophy and ethics and history of science and so on made him set up within the structure of the medical school the various kinds of not so much departments but at least programs that
humanistic programs
that would serve those ends. And since in general I'm much in favor of that kind of thing, and I admit had many talks with Lester Evans too, of course, about these things, I felt that we needn't clash over matters in which we really saw essentially eye to eye.
Right.
But I know it troubled John a great deal that Ed didn't do any reporting and essentially wanted to be completely autonomous of the central administration of this campus. And he sometimes acted as though he didn't need to work things out with John in an administrative way, the budget matters and so on. He'd draw up his own budget and he'd present it in Albany, and that was that. And if it was so big that it would lead to a cut in the part of the SUSB budget that was going to arts and sciences, well, it didn't matter so much to him. I'm very fond of Ed Pellegrino. I think that choice was very good, but he's also an extremely difficult man, and he has gotten discouraged in post after post he's held because I think he wants always more than is reasonable. Most of the jobs, even when he became president of Catholic University in Washington, he didn't stay there very long. He couldn't work within the necessary constraints.
Yeah.
And well, essentially the recruitment and the administrative framework of the Health Sciences Center was entirely Ed's responsibility. I'd have no hesitation in saying I had relatively little to do with it. John had relatively little to do with it. We picked a man who knew his own mind. Now, I think perhaps the next thing to go into is the certain problems of appointment and tenure that had to be worked out. One of the difficulties lay in the Department of Music, where we had some very distinguished people who were musical performers, not rather than academic scholars. And they were on part-time positions and not very well paid, with no tenure and no real status. And I felt this was unjust, unfair to them. If they, I believe that in setting the policies for the development of the music department, I succeeded in what I dreamed of, making it one of the best in the country. And the solution was to persuade, gentle pressure, the academicians in the department, who the chairman and the faculty members, that part-time persons like Bernard Greenhouse and right. Martin Cannon and Gilbert Kalish and
Sam Baron,
all of them, deserve better treatment, and that they could build up a very, help to build up a very distinguished department. It would be second to none in the SUNY system, and I think now it's second to none anywhere. I think it's on a par with Juilliard and Indiana and very few other outstanding schools of music. This was to get them to agree that these appointments, if the individuals had served a reasonable length of time and were willing to take a permanent status on the campus, then they should be given tenure the same kind of title as those who went up through history of music or composition or whatever. And that worked out pretty well, I think. We didn't lose anybody that was a key person in our early development of the music department.
The only person I can think of is Lewin, who went to Yale.
Well, he was in composition.
Yes.
And history of music,
right.
Rather, and I was just going to mention him. It was on the other side that we lost people, not among those who were the teachers of musical performance.
Right. Well, they were closer, being at Stony Brook, they were closer to New York City.
Yes,
we have
a great advantage to us.
We have an advantage there.
And then, as we established the Center for the Marine Sciences, one of the first jobs was to find a director for that. And, I, before we even got a director, two young faculty members from Oregon came by visiting, and I was much impressed with them, and managed to snare one for the Stony Brook faculty. That was, names.
Weil was one?
Huh?
Weil?
Yes, Pete Weil.
Pete Weil.
He was the first one.
Right.
And the other man decided he would prefer to stay on the West Coast.
Right.
But then with Pete Weil, we, groundwork, we began to make the search for the director and to develop an academic structure that would enable a curriculum in marine studies to be formulated without necessarily overburdening it, which, since it was to be a research center, not a department, with academic people who were primarily concerned with teaching. And so the device I used there, which I also used with CED, was to get individuals who were willing, either from the biological sciences or from earth and space sciences, to accept an appointment in marine sciences for a limited number of years. Without, they would simply be on leave of absence from their regular department. They would have no teaching responsibilities for that period. They would have a chance almost to enjoy a sabbatical at home for a couple of years, you see, and get some research really going. And we got several very good people that way. George Williams moved over into marine sciences from biology, and we got several, Pete Weil, of course, and he had a joint appointment in earth and space sciences, and that worked pretty well.
When did Pete Palmer come in? Oh, no. He was in earth and space. Right. Okay.
Then we were trying to get this, I mentioned last time, this tropical station for the study of coral reefs and tropical marine problems started in conjunction with the University of Jamaica. We had an enormous number of conferences about that, and it looked like it was going through. We had a general approval from the central administration, but in practice it didn't seem to work out, because the people who went down there found that the University of Jamaica wanted to run things. And as far as the financing was concerned, the biggest need was for a good boat that could be used. And we couldn't get the central administration to put money into a boat that would be operating in foreign waters all the time. And in fact, in general, to transfer funds from Albany down to Jamaica proved an almost hopeless business. So poor Tom Garreau, who was brought into the Marine Sciences Center to head that tropical marine station, was tearing his hair out. And it just fell apart. On the other hand, Don Squires, when he came on board, was able to work out some very good relations, which I helped to firm up with the other university branches, and not just the graduate centers, but the colleges, so that persons who wanted to do marine research could come here. And we tried to get several other stations located, maybe off the coast of Maine or Massachusetts, but that didn't work out so well either. Anyway, the development of a local New York program thrived. And when Don Squires resigned and went to Albany. It was primarily to head the C. Grant College program, which had been presented to NOAA and was funded for a period of years and was intended to form a kind of conglomerate of the branches of SUNY that were interested in marine studies, but it would be some parts of it would be Great Lake studies, but most of it would be marine and would be located at Stony Brook. Go to CED. This was always one of my great hopes.
Excuse me just a second. Yes. Did you bring in Jerry Schubel?
No. That was about the time I retired, or a little after. I don't remember just exactly when he came. But after Don Squires left, we had a young man who was a professor in Earth and Space Sciences. What was his name? He was a very, very fine scientist and administrator. But he only stayed about in that position about 2 years, and then he went away about the time we got Don Squires. I think that was it. Can't remember his name.
All right, let's go to CED.
All right. I had long been impressed with the fact that the rapidly advancing technology of the world, the United States in particular, and scientific discovery, and advances in every field, produce such a tremendous obsolescence of education that all kinds of professional people ought to be undergoing a much more systematic upgrading and refreshing, retraining period periodically. Now, sabbaticals are supposed to enable people to do that, but they're not systematized, and they touch the university community almost exclusively, but not persons to any great extent in lower educational communities. Well, even the community colleges, I suspect they don't take their sabbaticals very seriously. And in secondary school, elementary school education, which I had been deeply concerned through the chairmanship of the Biological Sciences Curriculum Study for 6 years, it was very evident that high school teachers of biology, just as of physics and chemistry and math, coast along for decades on what they learned when they were in college, and they never advance beyond that, and they forget a lot too, so that there's a constant need to bring them back in and retool the educational community. And that must surely be true of physicians too, by and large. And originally I had thought that CED would have a big opportunity there, but that was one thing that Ed Pellegrino said, no, whatever continuing education in medical sciences to be done will be done in the Health Sciences Center, not in CED. So it became exclusively a matter for the College of Arts and Sciences to organize. Well, here again, the problem was to create a structure which would get talented and enthusiastic and devoted members of the faculty to participate in this kind of teaching of retraining the professional people. And in nearly every college and university at the time, the efforts made were a dismal failure, because These courses usually taught at night or weekends were considered to be something extra, not a part of the regular teaching load, and not something for which a regular faculty member would receive additional remuneration. Well, the additional remuneration is a sticking point, but as I saw it, any faculty member who participated seriously in continuing education should be have his remaining teaching load reduced so that he would have no more teaching to do than anyone else in his status, his department. And so a system of kind of rotating appointments, joint appointments, in which each department would, so to speak, send some missionary members to CED for a year or two, and then they could go back and new recruits would take their places. This would be greatly to the advantage of the departments, because it would enable them, with the additional teaching load as a total, to appoint more good people than they could if they were dependent simply upon the usual undergraduate and graduate student body full-time. And also, as it worked out, because of the method of accounting in Albany, where full-time equivalents are considered to be the arithmetical basis of figuring up loads and budgets and so on. The addition, let us say, of 3,000 part-time graduate students, each taking a third of a full academic load in the course of a year, would be the same as adding 1,000 graduate students, full-time graduate students. But they would not be nearly so expensive, because this kind of program that you could work out for retooling and retraining professional people doesn't require nearly the same amount of highly specialized equipment. And so the thing was to try to get a sufficient number of good people in the faculty interested in doing this, and then we got a certain number of new lines each year, I could put some of them in CED according to the teaching load that was to be met, and then parcel them out to the departments. The trouble is, it involved dealing with fractions of a person and fractions of a load. And so the chairman always seemed to find great difficulty in recruiting people who would, let's say, have half a load in arts and sciences and half a load in CED, even if there were, and they wouldn't look for people who had that kind of talent particularly, because they were afraid that those who were interested in continuing education would not become sufficiently devoted to their research and rise in the academic ladder to make tenure and become respected scientists or scholars. Well, I said that you've got to try to get then your very good established people who already have tenure, already have a reputation, to do this as a part of their load, and let the young man work for a while in development of their own professional advancement. Well, I wanted a person to head CED as dean who had similar ideas, was enthusiastic and a good administrator, of course, but who was not simply wedded to the idea that it would be not very distinguished or important adjunct of the regular educational program. I wanted to see it become virtually as important as the College of Arts and Sciences. And I don't know that I ever found more than one or two people who felt that way. David Weiser was the first choice, a chemist who had been in the University of Chicago in the college, had certainly the standpoint with respect to science that it should be a part of liberal education and not just a specialty for the development of technologists. And he was a good talker, that he had a great sympathy with the kind of possibilities that I outlined. But he didn't last very long. He had a joint appointment. I insisted on this, that these deans who came in would be given joint appointments in a department, so they would have tenure. And he had an appointment as an associate professor of chemistry. But after a couple of years, he decided that that's where his heart really lay, and he wanted out. And so I went hunting again. And this time I found Charlie Walcott, who was a biologist, been working with one of the curriculum programs at Harvard, I think it was, and MIT, either one or the other. Harvard.
Bird navigation was his field of research.
Bird navigation, that's right. And he came down, and he's a better administrator, I think, than David Weiser, but things began to move. I got my course in science and the future of man organized as a kind of backbone, and we got approval for the Master of Liberal Arts degree, and the enrollments began to go up and up in CED. Mostly the teachers in the community who were really enthusiastic. And I looked for senior members of the faculty who could really help in this. And I was lucky enough to persuade Max Dresden that this was a very worthy effort. And we worked closely together in that course for years. Nevertheless, when eventually I retired in 1976, there was nobody to be found to continue that course. The first plan was to have visiting lectures, sort of like the Provost lectures at the present time, distinguished people from all fields of science and philosophy to come in and lecture on a specific topic. And then the discussion groups would each headed by a particular faculty member or a senior graduate student would give the students a chance to talk these things over, and they would get assignments and write papers, and the real work of the course for them would be in the groups, but the lectures would be a kind of backbone for the whole thing. And it certainly stirred them up. I still have lots of people in the community who come to me and say, I meet them in the grocery store or on the street somewhere, and they say, well, I was a student of yours. That was a wonderful course. And we did have
a very broadening.
Well, yeah.
Very, gave them a background.
And
that they
people
didn't
like
have.
Pat Heelan, he was another person I recruited. You know, I had to fight for that appointment because there were a lot of people who were a little bit hesitant to have a Jesuit coming in as head of philosophy. They didn't know what would happen. Mm-hmm. But I talked with him enough to be quite convinced that he would make a good head of philosophy. And, well, after about 2 years, Charlie Walcott wanted out and wanted to get back to his bird navigation.
Yes.
And full-time work in biology. Well, it was all in accord with my principle of rotation. I didn't want deans who'd be fixtures and become dead wood anyway. And I think it was about that time that we got Frank Palmer in on a kind of a joint appointment in education, psychology, and CED. But he didn't want to do the administrative work, so that devolved on Mort Kreuter. And he was the most enthusiastic dean of CED we had. But, and actually I shouldn't be calling them deans, because I never succeeded in getting that position cleared in Albany. Maybe because John wouldn't push for it hard enough, I don't know. But Weiser and Walcott, Kreuter, they were directors of continuing education, they were not deans. Maybe if they'd been deans, it would have held them a little better. They didn't have enough distinction when they went into our bargain with the chairman of departments about the lines and who could come and teach a certain kind of course. We wanted people who would not just come into CED and teach the same kind of course they were teaching to the undergraduates or their graduate students. It had to be focused differently. Yes. It had to be a different kind of course.
Well, it was a different kind of need.
Yeah, a different kind of need. And it was so easy to see that, and yet the practical working out of it was a matter of a great deal of difficulty. And Mort Kreuter was the most enthusiastic of those directors, but administratively, he got pushed around. And by that time, we were discovering that these lines that had been assigned to CED had sort of vanished into the woodwork, because, let's say you have a line which you bargain with biology and say, well, you go out and recruit a good man to put on this line who will teach half of his load in CED, and we'll check out the appointment so that we know he's the right kind of person. And then if to fulfill the other half of the line, you must supply a half load from some of the other members of the department. Well, that's all very well in theory, but the fact is that after 3 or 4 years, the departments will look on this line as theirs, and if it falls vacant, they will go out and fill it without even passing the time of day with the director of continuing education. And to maintain that bargaining leverage requires a certain amount of aggressiveness and administrative knowledgeability that not everyone has.
Right.
Now, Lester Pauldy came in as dean after Kreuter gave it up, and that really gets into the period past 71. But I will say this, that I watched Les Pauldy and worked with him very closely from the beginning. He came to Stony Brook as a young teacher of physics at Cold Spring Harbor in high school there. He'd taken his BA here, and he was very, very interested in the development of science education, especially for
teachers in service. And he worked with, they had a number of faculty members in physics, of course, Ed Lamb and Schwartz, Cliff Schwartz.
Cliff Schwartz, yeah.
Schwartz especially, who were very emphatically kept the Department of Physics interested in science education.
Right.
And so I encouraged Les to get a master's degree and to take a position here. And when the position of director of continuing education was offered to him, I advised him to take it, but I said, don't do it unless they will make it a deanship. You've got to have some clout. And he was stout enough to insist on that and got the upgrading of the position. And then the problem came after he'd been with us 6 years with an appointment in physics,